This is Beth Smith. I'm at 431 West Sackett talking to Tom Baumann, and he's going to tell us about some of the things he remembers about early Salida. Hi, Tom.
Hello, Beth.
What can you tell us about yourself? When did you, where'd you come from?
Well, I was raised in northeastern Oklahoma, and as soon as I turned 17, I enlisted in the U.S. Army. Spent 5.5 years in the Army.
What were you doing in the Army?
I was in anti-aircraft guns, and then we converted to anti-aircraft missiles. And my last station was down in the Dallas-Fort Worth defense area, Denton, Texas.
Were you overseas at all during your service?
Yeah, I spent 2.5 years in Germany, and that's when we converted from guns to missiles while I was in Germany. And that was interesting. We went down to El Paso each year to qualify. We had to do a firing qualification down in El Paso, and we were fortunate enough to, or good enough to, win the best missile battalion in the U.S. Army trophy for 1 year. I think
oh,
it was 61.
Congratulations.
Yeah, so we were proud of that. We got to keep the traveling trophy in our day room for 1 year until someone else got it the next year. And when I got discharged from Germany, I was looking for discharged from the Army, I was looking for a job on the outside. I was tired of the Army by 5.5 years and thought there was better things for me to do. I didn't want to make a career out of the Army because it had gotten kind of boring or something to me at the time. So my mother and stepfather were living at Climax, and he was employed at Climax. And she told me about the employment possibilities up there. Oh, yeah, they wrote and told me about the job opportunities there, so I decided that that might be the best place for me at the time. So I got on the bus, and it was April of 9th of April, 1962. And when I left Dallas, while I was in short sleeves, nice warm weather, and I got off the bus at Climax, and Climax is on the top of Fremont Pass at 11,560 or 70 feet, and it was snowing. I got off the bus in knee-deep of snow, still snowing. Snow banks around the parking lots where they'd plowed the snow off were like 20, 25 feet high all the way around. As it turned out, that was the largest snowfall in like 10 or 15 years at Climax. There was like 365 inches of snow that year.
That 1962?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that was pretty interesting for me. I thought I'd maybe come to Alaska or something instead of Colorado. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, a lot of people think that that's the type of weather we have in Colorado anyway, is like Alaska or something, a lot of snow and cold. So I wasn't really too surprised. I was, because of that time of the year and whatnot. And so I went over and hired out and got orientated. And I was working 7-day production when they put me on. I was on a repair crew. And what the repair crew does is they go in and repair these, they call them drifts, but they're a tunnel in the layman's language, but in mining language, a drift is a tunnel. We go in when they've caved in and we repair them. We take all the old broken rock out and timber and rails or whatever else is in there that's been damaged from the cave-in. Caving in is what it's doing. And so we remove all that, and then we go in and we put new tracks and new timbers and timber sets, and sometimes we have to bar down some of the loose rock so that it don't fall down while you're in there working on it. And I worked at that for 1.5 years, and then I decided that there wasn't much room for an advancement on that job, so I transferred to the production crew, which they call a muck crew up there. And that's where they load the ore trains. And I was transferred over. Well, actually, I got a loader's bid, what I did. Which, up at Climax, when you want a job, you bid on it. And if you have the seniority and the know-how, you know, if you know how to do the job and you have the seniority, they award you that bid. And that's how I got over onto the muck crew. And I worked on the muck crew for about three and a half years. What we do on the muck crew is we load the ore trains or run the ore trains, operate them.
Just a minute, Tom. Are you calling that a muck crew?
Or a production crew, muck crew.
Muck. All right. So just the, a good word.
Production crew was called a muck crew. Production is a kind of a general term for the people that work for wages. They have management that are on the staff, and then they have production and maintenance, P&M hands. And the term was muck. Muck is a term for broken rock, loose rock. Whenever you want to clean a drift out, you muck it out. And then you, most of the muck that's found underground is ore. So that's kind of a word that works for both ore and broken rock, stuff like that. So I worked there for about 3.5 years. We had to shoot a lot of dynamite while we were on that crew to get to keep the rocks flowing into the loading dashes that we loaded the muck trains with, or the ore cars. And so we had quite a bit of fun it was fun for a young guy to shoot a lot of dynamite and stuff up there. I was up there in 1964 when they had what they call the Big Blast. And what they had done is they found an ore body in a spot up there in the center of their glory hole. Their glory hole looked like a donut. That's the way their ore body was formed, like a donut. And the center was mostly waste muck. And so if you ever look at the... It doesn't look that way now because of the open pit operations, but at that point in time, it looked like a bunt baking dish. You had the center that stuck up, and then you had the trough or whatever that went around the outside of the center.
But how big was this?
How large was the opening? Mm-hmm. It was probably a mile across. At the time I hired out up there, it was the world's largest underground mine. Or wait a minute, I got to correct it. I think North America's the largest underground mine. I think over in South Africa they got diamond mines that are probably larger underground. Mm-hmm. But it was North America's largest and supposed to be the safest mine to work in North America, which still wasn't that safe. We still got a lot of people injured, and once in a while we'd get one or two people, one or two fatalities a year. On a bad year, we'd get maybe four or five people killed up in the mine there. And I decided that the more I could learn, the better off I would be, so I decided to change jobs again. And I wanted to become a welder to learn how to weld. I wanted to do something I could possibly use other than at a mine, so welding came to mind. So I transferred from the production or the muck crew over to the mechanic crew in 1966, and I worked there as a mechanic for about 3 years, and then a welding bid came up in the outside shop. It was called a Phillipson outside mine shop, and I bid on that, and I started welding, and I welded for about 8 years in the Phillipson shop above ground. And after 8 years of that, I was wanting to learn some more stuff, so I transferred to the electrical crew in 1979, and I was working at the electrical crew until I was retired. I got a disability retirement from Climax in 1982 because of a heart condition that I had.
Now, when did Climax close?
I think they closed finally in 84.
So you were out of there by that.
Yeah, I'd already left there.
Can you tell us something about molybdenum?
Well, molybdenum has a lot of uses, and back when I first went there, they used it a lot in the space age, in the nose cones. It has a real high heat resistance, melting point. Mm-hmm. And so they use that in a compound that they make their missile nose cones and stuff with in order to keep from burning the tips of their missiles and their rockets and stuff that they were using in space exploration.
Well, did you live up at Leadville all this time?
No, I started out, I was at Fremont Pass, top of Fremont Pass with my mom and stepdad. And then in 1962 they had the strike. The labor went on strike. And so...
How long did that last?
It was 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to go out and... They had picket walkers and people that lived actually in Leadville that probably couldn't just go out and find another job. So the people that could, and I was one of them, so we just went and looked for another job while the strike was going on. And I'd went to Denver and went to work at a warehouse there as a warehouse man for More Value Stamp Warehouse. And that was kind of fun, but it wasn't very profitable. They didn't pay near the wages that Climax did. And so in January of 63, Climax settled their labor dispute with the union, and we went back to work. The guys at the warehouse in Denver wanted me to stay there because they liked my work, but I told them that I couldn't afford to give up that much money and stay there and work. So I went back to Climax, and then when I did, we didn't live up in Fremont Pass anymore. We'd rented a place in Buena Vista.
Were you married by that time?
No.
No. Mm-hmm.
And so we lived in Buena Vista for about a year and a half, but my stepdad, he was kind of a ranch person, and he wanted to find a place sort of out of town where he could keep some horses. And after a year and a half in Buena Vista, we moved down to Poncha Springs, and we rented a place on Gene Adams Ranch there in Poncha Springs. And we had about 5 acres we could keep horses on, plus the house that we were renting from him. And so we lived there about 4 years. And
you commuted to Climax all the
time? Yeah. Each time in Buena Vista and in Salida, I would carpool or ride up in a panel that some of the other workers was operating.
There were a lot of people that were commuting up to Climax, isn't there?
Yeah, I understand that when Climax closed down, they displaced about 300 families here in Salida alone.
Yeah.
And that was probably 300 men that were working up there. There might at the time, there were a few women working up there. That was kind of interesting to be working up there all that time, and then all of a sudden they had to hire women to go underground, and they had to change some of their bathroom facilities and
sure.
and things under there, and they didn't change them that much, which was pretty comical because the poor ladies that was underground there, our bathrooms consisted of just kind of like a porta potty under there, and they didn't enclose it most of the time, but I think once the women there, why they had to put a kind of a little enclosure around it. It wasn't sealed in or anything. It was kind of open air, but It was kind of like putting dressing curtains or something around the...
There used to be quite a superstition about women going underground in any kind of mining. I know I was from Louisville, where they have coal mines, and that was a big thing over there. Women didn't go underground. In fact, I wanted to go underground one time to see what it was all about, and Ed's uncle said, no, said, you can't go.
Well, there's a few old coal miners up there at Climax that had went up there and went to work, and they were pretty upset when they started letting women go underground. I remember the first time I seen a woman underground, she was with an engineer crew that had come out of Colorado Mines, School of Mines, and they were up there looking around at our operation, and of course underground there you couldn't tell a man from a woman because they had hard hats on and coveralls and boots and safety glasses, and they probably just looked like a small man instead of a woman. And that was quite a deal up there. It was interesting. Underground like that, it is so dark that if you turn your lamp off and there's no other light around, you cannot see nothing. It's like being totally blind. And occasionally our lamps would run out of battery power. When I hired out up there, they had battery lamps. And you had a lamp room that you picked your lamp up before you went on shift, and then you'd turn it in and put it into the charger as you left. Well, if somebody took your lamp by mistake, you know, were in a hurry and grabbed the wrong lamp, then they would double shift your lamp, and then when you went in on the second shift, it would run out of charge on you. And you'd just have to feel your way around with your feet and your hands when the light went out, unless there was someone there that could kind of lead you to a lighted area like a lunchroom or someplace like that. And so that was kind of interesting too.
Scary.
Yeah, and there's lots of scary stuff that goes on underground up there. Whenever they'd shoot a blast, and the ventilation sometimes would be wasn't working properly, you'd get so much dust that you couldn't see. And, of course, we wore our safety respirators that kept the dust out of your lungs and stuff pretty much, which, while I'm on the subject, I'm happy to say that I didn't get any silicosis while I was up there in the 20 years. I was only underground 10 years, but that was plenty of time to get it if I hadn't taken precautions to keep from getting rock on the lungs, as they call it, silicosis. And underground, after a while, you got comfortable just like in your living room, you know. You didn't have any anxieties or anything about being underground. In fact, in the cold weather, it was warmer under there than it was outside. It was probably 40 degrees year-round in most places, unless you were close to a place that had a hole that was going up into the outside temperature, and then it'd get pretty cold, start freezing the ice and stuff under there. But otherwise, you'd just wear a shirt with long johns, and or maybe a light jacket with long johns and full long johns. We wore steel-toed rubber boots that came up just below your knee. And inside those boots, they had a little steel flexible pad that you stuck in the bottom of your boots to keep from getting any nail punctures in your feet. And of course the boots would take the brunt of it if you stepped on a nail or something, and it was really depress a guy because those boots cost like $25-$30 a pair, and you know, they weren't even hardly broke in sometimes before you got holes in them, and then if you got in water, why, you had wet feet all day. So that was kind of fun. We used to do it. We weren't as safe up there as we were supposed to be. We got a little reckless sometimes. And if it was the last train that we were going to load for the shift, sometimes we'd jump on the train and get in the ore cars and ride outside rather than go down and gather at this one spot and ride the man trip out with a big bunch of guys. You get a few minutes to jump on the people going out and going into the dry to change clothes. They called the clothes changing building the dry, which is kind of fun. You had benches along a row of lockers, and then they had chains with pulleys in the ceiling and baskets on them for your wet clothes. And a lot, you know, being underground like that, there is a lot of water, and so your pants would probably be wet clear up to your knees most of the time. And when you'd come out and change clothes, you'd open your locker and get your clean clothes out of the locker, take your old dirty clothes, which they called diggers, was their term for dirty work clothes, and they would hook them onto this basket and then reel them up into the ceiling where the heat was, and then they'd be dry the next time you come for the shift. Sometimes they were so stiff you couldn't hardly get in them. From
smart
the muck
idea.
And the water and everything.
Smart idea, though.
And I don't know. I guess that's the only mine I ever worked at. I'm not sure how other mines had their dries or what happened, but they had a safety method up there to find out how many people were inside under the mine. And they did this, they had a 7-day production under there, but there would, between shifts, there would be supposed to be nobody under there. And they did this for their blasting purposes. If they had to do any blasting, why, they would make sure everybody was out from underground whenever they set their shot off. Sometimes they're big shots. And so they needed to clear the whole mine for that. Not to mention the dust and stuff that went on. And so when you checked in up there to go underground, you went to see your boss for your crew. And he had a window there, and he had a board where he hung these brass chits with your work number on them. And when you would come in, he'd hand you your brass chit, and you would put that in your pocket, and you'd go underground, you'd keep it all shift, and then when you come out at the end of the shift, you turned it in, and he hung the brass up, and then he could tell if there was anybody that was missing, because if the brass chit was missing, and there was something wrong, they'd have to go find that guy and see if he was underground, or he just forgot to turn it in, or what.
Yeah.
So that was a kind of a unique way of keeping track of the people up at their mines, which, you know, most jobs you don't have to do anything like that. It's just kind of a thing that has to be done for mining.
I saw one of those chit boards in a coal mine, too. Same thing.
Yeah.
Hang up your little...
They must have invented that over... I think most of your mines were invented in England, your coal mines and stuff, and a lot of your miners in this country came from Cornish, England, and so they adopted a lot of their habits and stuff. Another thing that was kind of took a little getting used to is riding their cages and their raises and whatnot under there. Sometimes their cages would be just big enough for two people, like a coffin for two people made out of expanded wire steel where you could see the rock and everything as you're going up and down. I rode one of those one time from Phillipson level down to Stork level a couple of times. And that was kind of scary because if you got trapped in there, I don't know if you could get out or, you know, if your hoist quit, I don't know how you'd get rescued. They did have some kind of a system in there where you could pull a rope and send bell signals to the hoistman, but, you know, if your power went off, I don't think they would... Of course, the hoistman would know if somebody was on there or not.
It never happened to you, huh?
No, it never happened to me, but that was kind of scary when you'd only get two or three guys in a little old close space like that and start going down a down a raise.
Anything scary ever happened to you personally?
Lots of times.
I bet.
When I was working on the muck crew, well, when I was working on the repair crew, sometimes you would be in there where it caved in and you're removing some of the old broken rock and stuff, and once in a while a piece of it would fall out and hit you while you're under there because you didn't have support under it yet. You're cleaning everything out before you put the timbers and support under it. And there are several times I got hit. It just wasn't anything large enough to do a real, you know, lasting damage to me. You know, maim for life type thing like some people were. Mm-hmm. And sometimes your muck trains would, or your ore trains in those areas there, it would be real tight, and if you had to go by one of them, you'd have to get down and crawl underneath them or just go sideways and just kind of skim along between the side of the tunnel, which they call the rib in the drift. And occasionally there was people that would be trying to slip by these trains, and these train drivers wouldn't know it, and they'd start the trains up, and it would catch them in between there and injure them pretty bad. I know two people here in Salida personally that got injured being caught between two trains like that, and it kind of broke them up, ribs and shoulders and stuff. Mm-hmm. One of them is George Hazel that lives out in halfway here between here and Poncha Springs, and another one is Jim Ashley. And Jim, he's the maintenance man over at the Chavano Manor at this time. And then there was another guy by the name of John Hunter that was on the repair crew with me that got broken up that way. So there was a few times I just barely missed getting squeezed through there, and then they'd start the train up, and I'd realize how lucky I was. I wasn't in there when they did that. Because those trains will grab your clothes, and you can't, you know, the old sides of those trains are kind of got little barbs and stuff sticking out on them, not intentionally, but just through the rough treatment of rock and stuff. And they're rough, and they'll just grab your clothes and pull you right through them tight spots, like pulling you through the wringer on a washing machine.
Yeah, mining's a dangerous occupation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were kind of careless in their blasting and stuff, and they'd get hurt that way. But I went on the mechanic crew, and that was kind of fun and interesting. We had to pack everything around on our back, our parts and our tools that we needed to repair whatever we were working on. Most of the time it was a big double-drummed hoist that we were working on. They called them slushers up there, was their name for them. And they were used to pull those folding dippers.
Now, when did you move into Salida?
I moved into Salida in 1964. Mm-hmm. And we moved from Buena Vista down here in 64. And we lived on 5th and G. Mm-hmm. We lived there for, not too long, probably 6 months, 8 months, and then we found a place out in Poncha Springs where we moved and lived for about 4 years out there. Then at that point in time, I moved away from home. I didn't want to live at home anymore with my mom. I thought I was doing them a favor, but as it turned out, it was just making things harder for her. So I moved down to... got me a hotel room in the Victoria Hotel. Mm-hmm. There was a nice couple there that owned it, Mr. and Mrs. Kelly, and they kept it nice. I had a room there for looks like $28 a week, with maid service, and it was just a sleeping room. And then I would take my meals at Neil's Cafe, which was just across the street, which is now Mama D's, but there was a little lady in there by the name of May Prenny that ran that after her husband died. Her and her husband had opened that up, and they had a contract with the railroad, the way they got started in that business, to stay open 24 hours a day so they could feed the railroaders coming in and going out.
Any time of the day or night.
And so at the time I... moved down there next to him. Why? the railroaders had quit running through here so much, so she wasn't open 24 hours a day anymore. I think she'd close about 6 or 7 in the evening and open about 4 in the morning so she could feed some of the people going to work early. I'd be over there about 4:30, 5 o'clock, having breakfast. She'd pack my lunches for me, and away I'd go.
Mm-hmm.
Carpool would come by, pick me up. When you worked at Climax and lived in Salida, it took you 12 hours. Round trip, you'd leave at maybe 5 in the morning, and you'd get back 5 in the evening.
Long day.
On a day shift, and then, of course, I worked 3 shifts in, and I'd go to work sometimes 3 in the afternoon and get back like 1 or 2 in the morning on the swing shift. And then graveyard, you'd leave at, I think I'd leave at 10 o'clock because you'd have to be up there to go to work at 12. And then you'd get off at 8, and then you'd get back into town about 8 or 9. Mm-hmm. And the guys that used to work graveyard used to have a saying, boy, this graveyard's really got my life messed up. Says, I go to bed hungry, and I go to work sleepy. My life is completely turned around with this graveyard.
Right.
Some people, though, that got used to graveyard, they liked it if they worked it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because usually at a job like that, there wasn't as many people up there in the mine, so you could get around the mine a lot easier on swing and day shift because you only had like a third or two-thirds of the people there. About a third of the people that worked at Climax Underground were day shift only, and they were usually maintenance and mechanics, stuff like that.
How many people did Climax hire at their peak when they were going great guns?
They had about 3,000 people
mm-hmm.
at their peak.
Mm-hmm.
And that was split up between administration and underground. We had two main mines then. We had the Phillipson level, which I worked at to start with, and then they had the Stork level they had developed, which was just below there. And then they had their outside people that warehousing and...
Well, let's go back to your living in Salida. Now, when were you married?
I got married in 1971.
Mm-hmm.
And
what was your wife's name?
Her name was Dorothy Gallegos.
Mm-hmm.
Her dad was a longtime railroader, and they lived over at 511 West 2nd, where they live now. And she had a sister, just the two of them. And they'd been living here ever since they were pretty small. Their dad came in and started working for the railroad. I'm not sure when, but he had about 20 years with the railroad when he retired. And we've been living in this little house here ever since we got married.
Mm-hmm.
We bought it the same year. And since we didn't have any children, we didn't feel the need to get a bigger house. I offered to buy a bigger house for Dorothy, but she said that she was satisfied with this one. And since it was so close to her parents, why, she was pretty pleased about that. She didn't want to relocate any further away or anything. So we've been married ever since. We've been married now 34 years.
Fine.
Mm-hmm. We just had our anniversary, the July 3rd. That's when we got married in 71.
So what do you remember about living in Salida? Now, you were out of town most of the time working, but people or clubs or something that you worked with, anything there?
Well, when I was working 7-day production, well, there wasn't too much social life for me because you couldn't really, you know, do anything a certain time every month like you can when you have a day work. But there for the first 7-8 years, why, I didn't really socialize with too many people in Slide unless they were workers up there, which there was several, you know, and I'd get to meet, and we would kind of do our own little get-togethers off work. We would have beer parties and stuff like that. They would get a little rowdy at times.
Mostly, though, with other Climax workers, huh?
Yeah, with other Climax workers. Mm-hmm. And, of course, since I've been retired, well, I've had more time to meet more people around Salida here. But, yeah, Salida's really grown in the last 40 years that I've lived here. There's a lot of places where there were vacant fields, where they're full of houses now, like out west of the golf course. There wasn't hardly any homes out in there. And now it's getting pretty well filled up. And between all the bowling alley and Pontius Springs, there wasn't much there as far as homes and stuff, businesses. There wasn't hardly any businesses out on Highway 50 when I first came here that I can recall, bowling alley. And there wasn't any convenience stores in town to speak of. They had little hometown groceries, neighborhood grocery stores back when I first moved here, which was kind of convenient. And I can recall people traveling through Salida back when I was first here. They would start running out of gasoline, and they would be looking for a place to put gas in. And we said, well, depending on the direction you're going, your next place to get gas is either Canyon City or Gunnison.
Wow.
And then they brought in the 7-Eleven store. I think that was the first convenience store that came in. And then after that, while they started bringing in more convenience stores, now we got quite a few here. The one over here on First Street near me, there used to be a little gas station just a block west of there. It was a Cliff Bryce station, but it only stayed open like probably 8 o'clock in the morning till 8 in the evening. Closed down, and then when they redone that, they moved it down a block and built it where it's at now. And it was a Cliff Bryce station there. And it's changed hands a couple of times since then. Now it's called Phillips 66 First Stop is what they call all those all across the United States now, I've noticed. And we've got quite a few convenience stores out on Highway 50 now. Like I said, 7-Eleven was probably the first one, and then I think Loaf and Jug come in shortly after that. And then the Stop and Save came in. And then Travel on Conoco became a convenience station, but they're not open too late these days. But at first, they were a little store in Butcher Market when they first started that. Kind of I don't know if they sold gas, but I think they might have. Bill Manchine built that. And then they came in with sub shops, which I think that kind of died down now. I don't know. There's only one sub shop, and that's the Subway out there now that I can recall. But the first one was there near the bowling alley in that little store center by TJ's Liquors. There's a little section of that, and they had a Moonlight sub shop there that was kind of nice. And our first pizza shop, per se, was down on F Street. I think it's probably in about the 300 block of F Street in the middle there, just down from Fabulous Finds in that block, probably in the center of it. It was called Pizza Dispatch, and they used to have some of the best darn pizzas. Hmm. And you could call in and they'd deliver them free.
About when was that?
About 74, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. The reason I can recall that date is my uncle had come down from Alaska and was in the area that time, and he liked pizza. I was never much of a pizza person, but he did, and we'd order them out, and he would tell me how good those pizzas were, and they were good.
Mm-hmm. Well, now Climax is talking about reopening. Think you'll go back to work for them?
No, I wouldn't go back to work for them. I got a disability retirement from there, so they already terminated me because of health reasons, and my health hasn't gotten any better in the last 20 years. So,
what do you think? It's something that'll work if they open Climax? Is there a need for molybdenum now?
I read an article in the Colorado Central on Climax opening, and the guy that wrote it was a former Climax worker at one time. He didn't work there too long, probably a year, but he was a writer, and he wrote an article on it because he'd done some research on it, and I guess molybdenum is up to about $30 a pound now, and back when they closed, it had dropped down to about less than $3 a pound, and so it sounds like they might, but the problem is if they open and start flooding the market with a lot of moly, well, then it's going to bring the prices down, and that's going to be kind of counterproductive on their part for bringing it down. So they're walking a pretty fine line there as to whether or not to open that again.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes 2 years to get it geared back up, according to the writer that wrote the article, to get it all manned and machinery and everything and start production again. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of hard to say what the price of molybdenum is going to be in 2 years, because it's been fluctuating pretty wildly, I guess, in the last 20 years.
And that'll take a lot of money to get it going again, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Will it be the underground mining or the open pit?
I think underground mining up there is a thing of the past. I don't think they'll ever go back to that, because when I was up there and they had started their open pit mining, they could do their open pit mining so much cheaper per ton than they could underground mining. And so I think they'll just start from the top and keep digging down. If they ever do open it, it'll be open pit. And they'll probably have bigger and larger trucks and shovels, too, to operate it.
My goodness, for the looks of those pictures, they certainly had big ones when you were working up there.
Yeah, they did.
Okay, Tom, you got anything else you want to put on tape for future use?
Well, that's all I can think of at this time, so mm-hmm. I guess we'll just have to leave it at that.
All right. I appreciate your talking to us. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Beth.